So, welcome. Please excuse the delay. I hope the recording will work now. Today we have the last lecture, and first of all, I would like to finalize the lecture from Monday, which I didn't manage to bring to the end, and then we will look into a smaller final chapter, tone mapping. But first of all, we will speak about, or we will finish with KD trees. KD trees are a very interesting, very efficient spatial data structure to accelerate ray tracing. And the idea of KD trees is the following. We sort all our triangles into a single root node. We compute the bounding box of our entire scene, of all the triangles in our scene. And then we top down build a hierarchy. And we build the hierarchy by always splitting our nodes into two halves, and we always split along the longest dimension of the bounding box. And the position of the split plane can be varied. We heard about that on Monday, that we have different heuristics to how to determine the optimal splitting plane position. And once we found that split position, we subdivide a node into a left and a right child, and continue with the subdivision then recursively on the children until our nodes have less than a threshold number of triangles, something like 10, for instance. Yeah, as soon as they have less than 10 triangles, we make that node leave. And this is our spatial data structure, a KD tree. And the one nice thing about KD trees is that for every node, we only have, for every internal node, we only have to store very little information. In fact, we only have to store per node only which is the dimension in which we split and what is the split position. Yeah, and this exactly defines what is the left, what is the right half. And so this is all we have to store. So here we see such an example. So this is our scene. And you see here, for every node, what we store internally is just, in that case, we split in x direction at position 5.0. And this node, the children, have been generated by splitting in y direction at position 3.0, and so forth. So it's only very little information. And in fact, this allows us also to do the intersection computation very fast, or very efficiently. It becomes a very simple traversal of our data structure. This is how it works. So first of all, we need the notion of a near and a far child. What is meant with that? We can see here in this example. We have a node. That's here the larger box. We split that node with that plane here. And this is our ray. And now obviously this ray first hits the left and then the right box, right? First the left and then the right children. If our ray would go into the opposite direction like this, then this would be the first child that the ray sees, and this would be the second. And so it depends on the direction of the ray, and depending on that direction, for every inner node in our hierarchy, we can determine the near and the far child. The near child is the child that is hit first. And we usually try, it's preferable to always traverse the near child first, because if we find an intersection here in the near box, we can skip the far box, because we are usually interested in the first intersection. So we try to find out whether there's an intersection here, because if this is the case, we can skip the far child. So we don't traverse the hierarchy here, always with a depth search and always first go to the first child and then go to the second child, but we always traverse the children in the order in which the ray hits them. So that as soon as we found an intersection in that box, we can immediately stop and have an early exit. Okay, So, yeah, that's the first thing. Yeah, the notion of near and far. It depends on the direction of the ray. In fact, it's very simple. We just have to look at the sign of the corresponding component of the ray direction. So if our split happens in x direction, we look at the x component of the ray direction, and if it's positive, then the first child is the near and the second is the far, and if the sign is negative, yeah, then it's just the other way around. Okay, so that's simple, yeah? And now how do we do the traversal? Yeah, how can we do that efficiently? And here the key trick, in some sense, is the following idea. So we take, so let's say this is the current node we are during our traversal. Yeah. So to intersect our ray with that tree, we start at the root node. Yeah. So in the beginning, this is the root node. And now we compute the intersection of our ray with this root node. Yeah. So we get a T min and a T max, for our current node. Yeah. We get a T min. This is where the ray enters, and T max, this is where the ray leaves our node. Yeah. So, this is our start. Ah, yeah. And then there's one thing I also, no. Okay. Yeah, it was one of the slides before. This is our start. And now for the traversal, I already mentioned a few times probably that in particular, if we do that traversal on a GPU, then usually doing recursive calls is not a very good idea, because memory is always a problem. Yeah, in particular, the memory for stacks where all the data return pointers and so on is put. This is a scarce resource. Yeah. So what is preferable is to try to do the iteration, the traversal iteratively, and to use a stack to store unvisited nodes. And this works in the following way. So first of all, in that example, yeah, we compute the intersections with our root node, and this information, node, T min and T max, this information we put onto a stack. Yeah, the stack essentially is a kind of, can also be seen as a queue of nodes that still have to be traversed, for which we still have to do work. Yeah. And we initialize the traversal now by putting the root node into that list, yeah, onto that stack. And now we know, okay, this is a traversal that we still have to do. And now the traversal is an iterative process. Yeah, it always takes the frontmost element of that stack, or the top element of that stack, yeah, and tries to compute an intersection. And now there are two possibilities. Oops. Okay. Okay, done nothing. okay, now we have that one node on our stack, yeah? And now we look at that node, and there are two possibilities. Either it is an inner node, yeah? So it has two children, and what essentially we have to do now is that, yeah, we have to look at that node. We see it's intersected from here to here, for instance, yeah? Now it's an inner node, so we see it has two children, yeah? And we determine the near node, which one is the near, which one is the far, and then we put the near box, yeah, the near child onto the stack, and next the far child, yeah? So we replace the one larger node by two smaller nodes, yeah, on that stack. And next we, yeah, from the stack again, now we take the near node. This is also subdivided. Yeah, okay, let's make it like this. Yeah, this is also subdivided. So again, yeah, we push now the near and then the far on the stack. So up to now, yeah, whenever we take one inner node from the stack, we put two new nodes onto the stack. Yeah, so that sounds like, okay, that will explode. But in fact, it's not that bad, because here we already saw an example. Yeah, if it's split like this, obviously, yeah, that ray only intersects one of the two boxes here. Yeah, and so we take one off the stack and put one back onto the stack. And this happens, yeah, it's not really seldom. Yeah, so the stack doesn't get too big, in fact. And as soon as we reach a leaf, yeah, then now we have a leaf node, and now we have lots of triangles in that leaf node, or a certain number of triangles. Now we intersect all these triangles with our array, and if we found an intersection, we are done. Yeah, because we always work, first look at the near and then at the far intersections or children. Yeah, we know if we find an intersection within that node, then we are done. Be careful. At one point, I told you about that triangle like this here that is part of that node, but it has an intersection in the next node. So we only may stop if we found an intersection within that node. Yeah. Okay. Good. So if we didn't find an intersection, yeah, then we know, okay, there's nothing here. So we continue with the next node from our stack. Yeah. So essentially, yeah, we replace that recursive traversal more by something like a working queue. Yeah, we put a node onto that working queue. Yeah, and then we always take away elements from that queue. And for every element, yeah, we either get a result, or we find out there's no intersection, or we put new nodes onto that queue. Yeah. And this is how we replace that recursion by a stack. Okay. I mean, yeah, probably you know, yeah, that recursion can always be replaced with a stack, or I hope you can. And this is the way how this works here. Okay. So this is the general idea. So here we see that how that looks as code. Yeah. And you see it's, yeah, it's really a rather simple procedure. It has the stack, where we start by pushing the root node with the tmin and tmax parameters. In a minute, we will see why we need these. And then as long as the stack is not empty, we always take the top node. Yeah, we pop this, the top element. If it's a leaf node, then we intersect with the triangles, and otherwise we intersect with the children. That means we push the hit children, the children that are hit by the ray, on the stack in the order near to far. Yeah, so that's a rather simple procedure. Okay, and yeah, now the simple part are leaf nodes. I mean, that's very simple. We intersect the ray with the geometric primitives, and if we find an intersection inside the node, yeah, then we are done. Otherwise, we continue with traversal. Now, if we have an inner node, yeah, now we have this example, some node, then our ray, yeah, then we determine near and far. And if our ray intersects both, yeah, we put first the near one on the stack and then the far one. And if our ray intersects only one, maybe like this or like this, yeah, or whatever, like this, yeah, if it only intersects one, then we only put the one corresponding child onto the stack. Yeah. Okay, so that's also simple. Yeah, and now how can we make that decision? How can we find out which children we have to push onto the stack? Yeah, is it one, two, or so? So what we could do is that we always keep track of the bounding box of the children. It's not explicitly stored. Yeah, but we can, yeah, could somehow always keep that bounding box information and keep track. Yeah, so that we always know the bounding boxes for near and far, and then intersect the ray with these bounding boxes. We learned how to do that. But in fact, for in that case, it's simpler. Yeah. So let's look at this example. Okay. This is about determining which child is near and which is far. That's really very simple. It's just by looking at the corresponding sign of the ray. But the decision now, which children are hit, yeah, can be done as follows. We have, this is our node here. This is our current node. And we know the entrance, the ray parameter for the entrance and for the exit point. What we do now is that we compute the intersection of our ray with the split plane. And this is very simple because these split planes are axis aligned. Yeah. So computing the intersection with such an axis aligned plane is very simple because all these scalar products become very simple. Yeah, because the normal, for instance, is something like 100 or so. Yeah, so that can be done very, very efficiently. It's essentially, I think, a subtraction and a division to compute the corresponding ray parameter. So we compute the ray parameter for the intersection here. And now we can quickly differentiate these three cases, essentially. If the ray parameter for the intersection is larger than T max, yeah, then this intersection is after the interval where the ray goes through our parent node here. So that means the far node, the right node, is not hit, yeah, because if it would enter, it would enter here, and this is already after the interval where we're interested. So if t dist is the distance, the ray parameter for the split plane, if this is larger than T max, then only the near child is hit and we push only the near child. Here we have the other case. If T dist is smaller than T min, yeah, the ray goes from here to here. I'm afraid that's not too well visible on, but I hope you can see it on the slides then, on the PDFs. Now here, the ray comes from here to here. The intersection is before T min, yeah, so only the far child is hit. And if T dist is in between T min and T max, then both are hit. Yeah. So we first have to pull the near and then the far child. Yeah. So it's very simple. We compute T dist. Yeah. As I said, one subtraction and one division. Yeah. And then we have these simple cases. T dist larger than T max. Then we push the near child. Otherwise, we push the far child, and in the third case, we push both children. And in fact, to push, we also need the ray parameters where these boxes are entered. And in fact, we also have them at hand. In that case, yeah, if T dist is larger than T max, then we push the near child, and T min and T max are exactly the same as before. Here, for the right child, the same. And if we are here, then the ray parameters for the near child go from T min to T dist and from T dist to T max for the far child. Yeah. So everything is there. We only look at ray parameters. We don't have to keep track of bounding boxes and all that stuff. We only look at ray parameters. Yeah. And yeah, this is the code that remains. Yeah. So now here, this is the interesting branch. This happens when we traverse or when we found an inner node. Yeah. We compute the intersection with the split plane. That's very simple to compute. If it's larger than T max, we push the near child with these ray parameters. If T dist is smaller than T min, we push the far child with the same ray parameters. And otherwise we push two children. Yeah. That's all. That's the entire traversal code. Yeah. And you see here, when we have a leaf node, yeah, our stack becomes smaller. Yeah. Then we really process a node and put nothing onto the stack. In these cases, the stack doesn't grow. Yeah. We just replace kind of the top element by a smaller one. Yeah. Which brings us closer to the goal. And here, this is sort of the worst case. Yeah. Here we push two new elements onto the stack. Yeah. So the stack doesn't get enormously big. Okay. Good. So very simple algorithm. And because it's so simple and so rather, well maps, also to GPUs. Yeah. In fact, it's usually considered the fastest ray tracing algorithm, but it also has disadvantages in terms of, for instance, for a hierarchical bounding volume. That was the first approach that we learned last Monday. In hierarchical bounding volumes, we don't have the disadvantage that triangles can show up in multiple nodes. This is the case here. Yeah, if we decide that this is our split plane and we have that triangle will show up in multiple nodes. Yeah, this also has disadvantages. So there are relative advantages and disadvantages, but in general, I think this is still considered as the fastest acceleration structure. But for practical reasons, probably more often bounding volume hierarchies are used. The difference is not too big. Okay, then of course we also have to look at a few special cases, One special case is when the ray is parallel to one of the axes. Yeah. So in that case, we will always only traverse one child, and which one depends on the starting point of the ray. Yeah. So in that case, we have to look, whether the ray traverses that or that child, but we only push one object onto the stack. Okay. Good. Yeah, so I already started a kind of little discussion. KD trees or BVHs are the mostly used hierarchies. They all have slight relative advantages or disadvantages. Both require a pre-process. Yeah, and this pre-process can be very significant. If we have a large scene with millions of triangles, yeah, maybe billions of triangles if you render a movie, then this can really become very challenging to compute that data structure. I mean, imagine you have a billion triangles, and only to decide about the split plane, like here, yeah, all these triangles, and just to compute the SAH, you have to sort all these triangles to triangles on the left of the split plane or on the right. There are other methods that require to sort the triangles along this axis. Then you have to sort 1 billion objects. Yeah? There are fast algorithms to do that, but nevertheless, the overall cost becomes very significant. And there's always the danger that the building of the acceleration structure becomes more costly than the ray tracing afterwards. Yeah. So that must be very well balanced. For instance, yeah, it should be avoided that we have a pre-process that is in the range of O of n squared. Yeah, because the final casting a single ray is O of n. Yeah, in the worst case. That should all be balanced. Yeah. Okay. But in the ideal case, yeah, if we have a good acceleration structure, in the end, we have a ray traversal that is in the order of O of log n. Yeah, that means in logarithmic time, we can cast a ray. And essentially, I mean, it's sort of interesting, and that argument was already made about 20 years ago. I mean, if we ignore the pre-process, which of course we cannot, yeah, but if we ignore the pre-process, in the end, ray tracing is an O of log n procedure, and rasterization is an O of n procedure. Yeah. So asymptotically, once the pre-processing is done, ray tracing for large scenes should be faster than rasterization. And as I said already 20 years ago or so, people predicted, yeah, that ray tracing will scenes become more and more complex, and for that reason, yeah, ray tracing will win in the long run. That already has been predicted 20 years ago, and it's still continuously predicted. but in fact, it didn't really happen. One of the major reasons is that, of course, it doesn't make sense to ignore the pre-process. And the pre-process must be O of n. Yeah, and usually it's even more expensive than O of n. Okay, but nevertheless, in particular for large scenes, yeah, that's maybe a message, yeah. The larger the scene or in with ray tracing, it's not so much a problem if scenes get complicated. Yeah. Whether I only have a few triangles or millions of triangles doesn't make that much a difference. The major problem with ray tracing of large scenes is that my acceleration structure usually the entire acceleration structure should fit into memory. With rasterization, I have the big advantage. I can rasterize triangle by triangle. So in the worst case, I can store all my triangles on disk, yeah, or on a SSD or wherever, and rasterize them triangle by triangle. Yeah, I always need to know only one single triangle. Yeah, and I can rasterize many of these triangles. Yeah, I only need to locally know one single triangle. With ray tracing, yeah, the ray tracing operator can hit the scene anywhere. It's very difficult to predict that. So I need to know the entire scene, yeah, because ray tracing is a global operator. I need to have the entire scene in memory. And this is the major bottleneck when doing ray tracing, that the entire hierarchy needs to be somehow kept in memory. And if you consider, for instance, that for movies, yeah, these scenes can easily have 1 terabyte of data, yeah, with textures, with all that stuff. Yeah, this is the bottleneck, yeah, because now swapping strategies have to be considered and all that stuff. That makes it very complicated. Okay, good. And then there's one other point, one other observation. And this is, I mean, the pre-process should be as fast as possible, but on the other side, it turns out that the quality of the hierarchy, yeah, the time we spent on generating a good hierarchy usually pays or very often pays off. Yeah, it is spending a little bit more time in building a better hierarchy, in a better balanced hierarchy, in a more optimized hierarchy, yeah, will result in a big gain in intersection tests. Or the other way around, yeah, if you generate your hierarchy just using a very simple approach, yeah, just by always subdividing in the middle, for instance, yeah, that would be a very fast strategy. Yeah, so pre-computation time is low, but the ray tracing time then in that case is rather bad. Yeah, it can be easily a factor, yeah, really a factor of whatever, 5 or so, yeah, in traversal time. So and this is a still ongoing, yeah, research problem. Yeah, how can we build such hierarchies that really generate fast ray traversal and don't have a too long pre-process time? Okay, good. So much for the acceleration structures. Oh, now I'm already. Are there any questions on this? The last chapter is not too long, so there would definitely be time for questions. Okay. So if this is not the case, I would like to make a very brief look into something in a section which is called tone mapping. And this is something which is very important and which we completely ignored up to now. And this is the following. Up to now, when we did lighting computations, yeah, or shading, we always computed color values between 0 and 1. Yeah, usually. Yeah, we said usually we got values between 0 and 1, and when writing them to an image, yeah, we usually just scaled that to the range from 0 to 255, and then we are done. Yeah. But in fact, if we do ray tracing, yeah, we do physical based lighting simulation. So we compute physical quantities, and this range of colors, or the dynamic range of these values, yeah, is usually much bigger than the 8 bits that we have on normal monitors, on normal screens, and in normal frame buffers. So we somehow have to bring that together. Yeah, we have to map that large dynamic range of reality to these small, only 256 different gray levels that we have on a screen. And of course, the very same problem every camera has, every digital camera. Yeah, we take a picture of reality, and in the end, we get an 8-bit resolution pixel. Yeah, and somehow we have to map the reality to that small artificial range. And if we do that in computer graphics on a ray tracer, this is called tone mapping. And just to illustrate that, yeah, even normal cameras have problems with that. Yeah, if the dynamic range becomes too big. So here is an example, and probably you know that also from practice. Yeah, we have that scene. Yeah, and if we somehow select the exposure such that at least some parts of that room here are visible, then the outside is too bright. Yeah, and if we select an exposure so that we can see the outside, everything in the inside is far too dark. Yeah. And as humans, we don't have really problems with that. Yeah. In that case, we don't realize that the difference in brightness is so large, because our eyes are much better in adapting to that, and our brain can adapt to that. Yeah. And cells on the retina can, so here in the dark regions, yeah, they are more sensitive than chosen, and here less sensitive, yeah, so that we can adapt much better to that. But for cameras or also in rendering, this is really a problem. And so in for normal cameras, the problem is that they have a finite resolution, usually something like 8 bits, or better cameras have something like 12 bits, but in fact this is not sufficient for real world scenes. So people were thinking about how can we solve that, and probably your mobile phone, also your camera has this HDR option. Yeah, and HDR stands for high dynamic range, and the idea is illustrated here. So what we can do with a normal camera is that we take a picture of the same scene, but with different exposures. Yeah. So what happens here is that here we have a very short exposure time, and from image to image, the exposure time is doubled. So twice as much light arrives on the sensor. Yeah. Just because the exposure time is doubled. And so here we see an image which is generally too dark, but at least the light sources are very well visible. Yeah. And structures in the light sources are visible. And here we have an image which is completely overexposed, but the dark regions, the few dark regions, are very well visible. Yeah. And what these methods now, or what also your HDR mode on your camera usually does, is that it takes such images. Yeah. And from these many images, it computes one image with a high dynamic range. Yeah. Where both dark regions and bright regions have a high resolution. Yeah. So this image usually in the end, or maybe in the end, has for every pixel a floating point value. Yeah, so a much larger range of possible values than 8 bits of integer. And this is probably how it looks on your mobile phone. So this is with based on 11 images, or maybe 12. But in practice, yeah, on mobile phones, this is maybe done with 3 images. So this is an example, overexposed, underexposed, and this is the resulting image. Yeah. And here this from the building, that part comes from here, and the sky more comes from here. Yeah. And you see it's sort of the best of these both images computed into or compressed into one single image. But nevertheless, yeah, what is a problem here now is now that at least the relative brightnesses in this image here are wrong. Yeah. So here the fence, I think it's a fence, yeah, or whatever. Yeah. Or the trees here, the relative brightness between the trees and here that mill house. Yeah. The relative brightness is wrong. But at least, yeah, it's compressed such in a way that we can see everything, but it's a kind of, yeah, manipulation on the final image. Yeah. So that we can see all. And essentially, if we look at ray tracing, yeah, we compute images that have the dynamic range of a real world, yeah, very dark parts and very bright parts. And if we want to store them in a JPEG image, yeah, we still have to do that compression, and we have to do compromises like this here, yeah, that we change relative brightness, but at least get an image that looks, yeah, realistic to a human, yeah, because it looks like a human would perceive it. And yeah, this problem is in particular interesting because that high dynamic range is usually bigger than one would expect. Yeah, the human visual system can cope with that very well. Yeah, so we don't realize it. But in a real world scene, yeah, we very often have a dynamic range of multiple orders of magnitude. Yeah, so if we look at that example, we would have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 orders of magnitude. Yeah, that would mean the brightest parts in an image are 10 million times brighter than the darkest parts. Yeah, I mean, that's probably a very high dynamic range, but in general, it's higher or much higher than the dynamic range that is displayable on a screen, for instance, or on a printed photograph or so. Yeah, on a latest or on a modern screen, you usually have dynamic range of 1,000 to 1. That means a white pixel is, in a very best case, 1,000 times brighter than a black pixel. Yeah. And yeah, so that means we have a dynamic range of 3 orders of magnitude, but the real high dynamic range of an image is much higher. Yeah. So we still somehow have to compress these values into these values. Okay. And then there comes another property. I think in the introduction at some point I already spoke about that, but okay, just to repeat that here. Another thing is that normal screens do not only have a rather low dynamic range, but it's also the mapping of values in the frame buffer to radiance values that are emitted is not linear. That means the color, if I write to the frame buffer a 128, yeah, which would be 0.5, 50%. The pixel on the screen doesn't have a 50% intensity of the white pixel. Yeah. So there's a non-linear mapping between the colors I write to the frame buffer and the colors I see on the screen. And in fact, this mapping is usually described by such a gamma curve here, yeah, by such an exponential curve. So X is the value in the frame buffer and gamma is an exponent, which is usually in the range of 1.7 to 2.2. Yeah, and this results in a non-linear curve of the radiance we see on the screen and the value we write into the frame buffer. This gamma has sort of also historical reasons. Yeah, old CRT tubes had that gamma due to technical limitations. Yeah, that was a technical effect. But it was not really disturbing because it fitted nicely with a human visual system, which perceives differences in dark regions, yeah, smaller differences in dark regions, better than in bright regions. Yeah, so the human visual system is relative. So in dark regions, I can see much smaller differences or perceive much smaller differences in brightness than in bright regions. Yeah, and this fitted well, yeah, because it made dark regions bright regions it compressed because differences are not visible anyhow, and in dark regions, yeah, it spread it values, and this worked nicely. So essentially, now LCD displays or other displays mimic that behavior, yeah, just for compatibility reasons. It kind of is normal that images, or it is assumed that there is such a gamma behavior. And on some screens, you can even select, yeah, so the screen applies this gamma in some cases, and you can vary it just to adapt brightness values as you wish. But essentially, So here's a little example, which is really funny, yeah, because what we see here is obviously a gray square, but on my screen, and if you look at the slides in your PDF, maybe you also see this effect, you see that this square has two halves, and the left half is a checkerboard with black and white pixels. And because the pixels are rather small, we don't see the single pixels anymore. Yeah. So they mix to a gray value. And in fact, yeah, because half of the pixels are white and the other are black, this is kind of the color, really the color between black and white. This is really 50% gray. And this here is a uniform gray rectangle, the right half. Yeah. And in that case, yeah, I've chosen the color such that here on this projector, yeah, at least I cannot see a difference between the two, but on my screen, the right one is much darker. Yeah. So if you don't believe, yeah, can you see it? and we can look at this effect. Here in that little demo. Ah, okay. Now again here on the projector, yeah, it's similar. And now here with a slider I can change the brightnesses, yeah? So now you can see that it's really separate. And now what I will do is that here I select color as I select it so that I cannot see the difference on my screen. So now on my screen, they are the same, yeah? And on the projector, they are no longer. Yeah, so you see, yeah, this obviously, yeah, there's a nonlinear behavior. One would expect that I need to select 50%, yeah, so that both have the same, but they don't. And this is this nonlinear behavior. And obviously, the gamma correction of that projector and that of my computer are different. So this is where this difference comes from. Okay, so, I mean, it's a subtle thing, yeah, but it needs to be considered, and in particular, if we do physically based rendering, yeah, we might say, okay, maybe with my screen I want to reproduce exactly these physical quantities that I computed, yeah? So, in order to do so, I need to know that mapping of my projector or of my screen, yeah? And then I know I want to see that physical brightness, and then I have to do the inverse mapping so that I know which value I have to write to my frame buffer so that I, in the end, get the color I want. Yeah. And this means I need to know that gamma value of my screen and need to correct the values I write into the frame buffer. Yeah. Using the inverse operation. That means take it to the power of one over gamma. Yeah, and this is the value I write to the frame buffer, and then the screen does the gamma mapping so that in the end on the screen I see the original value again. And it's important, yeah, it's subtle, but there can be weird effects. So for instance, we have to be careful that we do this correction at the very end. So if we do, for instance, anti-aliasing on our images, yeah, that means for every pixel we should shoot multiple iRays, yeah. Then we should not on each of these iRays do the gamma mapping and then average, but instead we first have to average and then do the gamma mapping. That can make a huge difference if we have very bright spots in our image. Yeah, and all these filter operations and so on, we always should do that with physical values and only in the very, 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 very end. Just at the moment before we display it on the screen, we should do all these gamma corrections. And There are very weird, often rather weird things. So for instance, all these tools like Photoshop or so, yeah, what they very often do is that they do such a gamma mapping as soon when they load an image, they do such a gamma mapping and they also do it again immediately before they write it to disk. And then sometimes very weird effects happen, yeah, and you cannot explain it. And it's always this gamma correction. Yeah, so it's helpful, but it can also be a pain. Good, but that's not the major point of this lecture here. The question is, let's say we ray trace an image. Now we have all these physical quantities, yeah? And now we find out that the darkest point in my image, yeah, and the brightest point are 6 orders of magnitude apart. Yeah, the brightest point is 1 million times as bright as the darkest point, yeah, which is not uncommon. Yeah, so it's not an extreme example that can easily happen. And now we have the problem, yeah. How do we somehow we have to compress that now to 8 bits? How can we do that? And that's the problem of tone mapping. And in fact, if you're interested in that stuff, so there's a nice book, High Dynamic Range Imaging, Acquisition, Display, and Image-Based Lighting. It's available on Google Books. And yeah, some of the example images I show here are taken from that book. I think it has something like 700 pages, so it's really not a trivial thing. And what is what makes it difficult is, in order to do that compressing correctly, we need to at least a little bit understand how human vision works, yeah? Because a normal ray trace scene will have spots that are so bright, yeah, that this value, this physical brightness, cannot be produced by a screen, yeah, and that's screens are much darker than we think, yeah, and so we have to do the compression such that a human observer looking at that says, yes, that looks right, yeah, and because the human observer will see something different, yeah, but we have to understand how the observer perceives these brightness values so that we can do it in a way that the observer says that looks right. Yeah. And maybe that even varies from person to person, or it might be that for a human observer, it looks great, whereas a dog says it looks awful. But yeah, I mean, we don't care. And perception is very difficult. Yeah. And an interesting topic. Okay. Good. So tone mapping. Yeah, handles this problem. It tries to write images with low resolution, 8 bits or something like what can be displayed on the current screen. Yeah, it maps the large dynamic range to that much smaller one in the hope that looking at the compressed image, yeah, gives exactly the same perception like a real image. Yeah, something like photo cameras can obviously do pretty well, but as we saw in the introductory example, always also fail from time to time. Okay, and we can do that in two ways. So first of all, we can do that as last pass of our ray tracer, or what many systems do is that the ray tracer just outputs an image that contains float values. Yeah, so it doesn't worry about tone mapping at all. It outputs the full high dynamic range, and then we need a special image viewer, yeah, that does the tone mapping for you, and that maybe also allows the user to, in the end, adapt brightness values until the image looks right. Essentially, that's a kind of development process like there was with old cameras where pictures are taken on film. Yeah, then these images were developed and brought to paper, and there was still at that point it was decided whether it should be brighter or darker, and this can also be done with such viewers here. And even there are tools for professional photographers that are called development tools, yeah, that really develop that digital image. Okay, but how can that be done automatically? I mean, it's a large, we could do an own lecture on that, but just to give you a little idea. So this is an example rendering, yeah, of a room. And of course, it's the typical scenario, darker room outside. It's pretty bright. This is a rather good solution. Yeah. And, or this is how it maybe should look like roughly, but now we have, of course, the problem. Yeah, these pixels are very bright compared to these here, for instance, which are rather dark. And the first solution would be determine the darkest pixel, determine the brightest pixel, and then do a linear interpolation in between these two. And if we would do so, we would get this image, yeah, which is obviously not good. Yeah, the outside is well visible, yeah, but the interior is far too dark. Yeah? And it's just because these few bright pixels here from the sky make the entire rest far too dark. Okay, so we have to think about something better. And in fact, yeah, we should try and reduce the effect of these few bright pixels, yeah, because they dominate the entire image. And to do that better, we can look at, or there's one observation from which is from experiments, yeah, which obviously describes human perception of brightness. I don't speak of colors. I only speak about brightness, by the way. Color is, again, another very difficult topic. For now, we only look at brightness. And there's one equation that describes human perception pretty well, obviously. Yeah. And this is this equation here. And so let me try to explain it. On the left, so there's one problem with human vision. And it's this effect. Yeah, if you are in a dark room, your eyes adapt to the darkness. It takes some time. Yeah. And if then suddenly the light goes on again, yeah, things are a little bit too bright, yeah, and it takes a short time until you adapt to that, but afterwards you're completely fine again. Yeah, this is the way how human perception can cope with this. It's chemical processes on the retina, so that you kind of can adapt the level, the perception level. And so how bright we perceive a particular color, a particular intensity, yeah, does not only depend on that intensity, but on the entire surrounding, yeah, to the adaptation level. And in this formula, this sigma here is kind of the adaptation level. It describes the average intensity sort of in our scene. Yeah. So if I take a picture now, I have a certain adaptation level, yeah. And now, if I wait for some time with my eyes, I have another adaptation level, yeah. Just depending on the average brightness in the scene, and the very same part of the image looks different, or the perception. Of course, it. Yeah. Okay. Good. Stop. That was not a good argument. Okay. So this is the sigma. The sigma describes the average intensity in my scene, and now I is the intensity of a particular point in the scene. To this n we will come later. For now, let's say n equals 1, this exponent, yeah, n is an exponent. And now this ratio here is the relative perception of a particular point. R max is a point that we perceive as maximally bright. Yeah, it's like if you look into a laser pointer. Please don't do that. Yeah, but it's the maximum that you can perceive. And R over R max, yeah, is kind of the relative perception. So if this value is 0.5, you perceive it as 50% brightness. Yeah, it's kind of 50% of the maximum brightness you can perceive. And now this equation here just tells us, yeah, if I see something with intensity that has the physical intensity I, and the adaptation of the I is sigma, then this ratio here tells us how bright I perceive it. Yeah, this is the perceived brightness. If this is 50%, I perceive it as 50% bright. Yeah, and okay, so this formula is rather simple. And this n is now a sensitivity control exponent. Yeah, it varies from person to person, in fact. And it's a kind of parameter that still allows us to adapt that curve a little bit. Usually this value is between 0.7 and 1.0. But for now, or for many, yeah, it's just set to 1, because then it makes computation simpler. Okay, so here we see these curves, how they look like. So now, depending for different adaptation levels, for different sigmas, yeah? And what you can see here, so let's look here at this curve, for instance. This is for a sigma of 10, so in a rather dark environment, yeah? And here we see the physical brightness, yeah? This is what we get from our ray tracer. That's the physical brightness of a pixel. And this is the perceived brightness, yeah? And essentially, this is what we write into the frame buffer, yeah, with gamma correction, yeah? Because, yeah, I mean, essentially, we also have to apply that curve to the value that is output by the monitor. But the monitor is in a brightness range where this behavior is still rather linear. Okay, that's a very simple argument, but often these arguments here are very simple. Okay, yeah, so if we, for in a simplified setting, say that this is the brightness that our ray tracer delivers, and this is the value that we want to write to the frame buffer, yeah, we will see that here we have an interesting curve. It's not, or it's rather similar to what we get with gamma mapping, yeah? It shows us that essentially the dark regions we make much brighter, and the bright regions, yeah, in the bright regions, the curve is much flatter. So if we look to that example here, what it does, it makes the dark regions, it would make the dark regions much brighter, and here it wouldn't, yeah, the differences in the clouds or whatever, the differences in intensity here are compressed, and the differences in intensity here, the contrast here, is enhanced, yeah, and this is exactly what we want. And if we increase the adaptation, the sigma, then the curve goes down. So that means, yeah, the dark regions, yeah, become darker. This would be in essentially, we can get the difference here in that image. If we would say the user looks at this window, if this is the case, the eyes more adapt to that bright part, and then automatically this part becomes less visible. Or if the user looks at this part of the image, yeah, then the eye more adapts to that region, and then this part becomes better visible, but here contrast gets lost. Yeah. So this adaptation levels sort of, yeah, describes how our eye has adapted or adapts currently. Yeah. And it's comparable with the aperture in a camera, or maybe with the exposure time. Yeah, it tells us how light is mapped to colors on film. Okay, so yeah, here, yeah, we have now these different exposure curves, or yeah, that would be different exposures. Maybe you can also imagine the size of the iris, yeah, that also adapts to the brightness. But in fact, the size of the iris is only a minor contribution to that. It's more chemical processes in the retina. Okay, and for different sensitivities, these curves can also change. But as I said, yeah, this part is probably the most important one. And now usually these curves are presented in a logarithmic scale, and then they look like this here. And what you see now is that in this middle range, obviously now the sensitivity of the eye is linear with the logarithm of the intensity. Yeah, and this is why many people say that the eye has a logarithmic or an exponential, yeah, if we take it the other way around, response to light. Or let's put it the other way around, yeah, doubling the intensity, yeah, is perceived as a constant increase of intensity. And yeah, this is because here these curves here in that range are rather linear. But here in the, of course, in this range and in this range, this is no longer the case, but here they are rather linear. Okay, good. So much about how it is perceived. Yeah, how can we now derive a tone mapper from that? Yeah, so first of all, we obviously it's important that we compute this parameter sigma, yeah, the adaptation of the eye. In a bright scene, outdoors, skiing, yeah, sun, blue sky, lots of sun, very, very bright, then the sigma will be a rather large value. If you are in a dark room, yeah, then the sigma will be a small value. And essentially, yeah, this controls the mapping to frame buffer values. And we can simply define it as 50%, or this defines the 50% brightness. Yeah, sigma is an intensity in our image, so it has the same units as the ray tracing result values. And this value is always mapped to 50% brightness. Yeah? If we look at that formula, if we have an intensity of sigma, yeah, then we have sigma over sigma plus sigma. This is 1/2. Yeah, this is sigma is the value in the end. If we use that curve, that value will be mapped to 1/2. And a very simple compromise would just be to take the average brightness in the scene. Yeah. And now there are different ways to compute the average brightness. We could use the average logarithmic value and take the exponential. Yeah, there are different ways to compute the average, and we can only whatever we can throw out the 10% brightest and 10% darkest and only compute the average of the rest and so on. There are many variants to compute that sigma. And also we can use the parameter n. Yeah, that's more a user-defined parameter than to do the fine-tuning in the end. And in fact, yeah, there are several different sorts of tone mappers that are all based on exactly that formula, but that mainly vary in the way how the average brightness is computed. So one is Tumblin-Rushmeyer. So you see here that looks rather complicated, but in fact, it's exactly, it boils down to a very simple formula like here, yeah, and or an operator from Reinhardt. That's exactly the operator that we saw before here. This is very often used, and sigma is computed by different ways as I described it before. And it essentially always boils down to a variant of that one, and there are many, many more different operators. So just to show you from Wikipedia, if you look at tone mapping, yeah, you will see very different operators. This is Reinhardt, for instance. These are other, and you see the differences are significant. Yeah. Okay. And here another example for the Reinhardt operator. So this would be a linear map, for instance, where the darkest point gets black and the brightest point gets white. And yeah, here we see with Reinhardt's operator, yeah, I think it's clear that here much more detail is visible. It's probably a better solution than here. Okay, and then there's one other thing. I told you that image here. I was speaking about the following observation. So probably if you're in that room in a real world and you look at the outside, yeah, you look out of the window. So in the center of your image, yeah, you will see something very bright, and probably the eye will adapt to that, yeah, because the center of the image is more important. And what that means is that the eye adapts, the sigma goes up, and you will probably recognize details outside better, yeah, but in the inside contrast will get lost, yeah, because you adapt it to the outside, yeah, and so the inside is underexposed. And if you do it the other way around, if you look here in your image, yeah, then you will adapt to that one and will recognize details here, but now this will be overexposed. Okay, now you have a problem, yeah, because when you do the tone mapping, you don't know where the user looks at, right? You have no idea, yeah? Ideally, the user should be able both to look here and to look here and see the correct thing. So probably this tone mapping should be somewhat local, yeah? So if I look at that part of the image, I can assume that the user adapted to that region. And if I look at that part of the image, I can assume that the user look to that region of the image. So the sigma, it would make sense to let the sigma vary over the image. Yeah. And this is what's called a local tone mapper. And of course, we cannot do that. We may not exaggerate. Yeah. Because if in the end, this part becomes as bright as this part, yeah, then that will again look wrong. Yeah. Because we can switch. Yeah. And let our eyes wander. And, yeah, then this will also be wrong. But this results in so-called local tone mapping operators. And that means, yeah, we compute the sigma, the adaptation, varying over the image. And of course, we cannot do that for every pixel. Yeah. Because if we compute the sigma for every pixel, in the end, everything will be 50%. Yeah. That doesn't make sense, but we can compute the sigma just looking at a region around a point. Yeah. So to compute the tone mapping for a pixel, we look at the surrounding region, compute the sigma for that. And with that sigma, we compute the tone mapping for that pixel. And this can, for instance, happen by just computing a very blurred version of our image, yeah, strongly blurred, and take this as the sigma and then to do a tone mapping with that sigma. And here we can see a result from that. So you see we have a typical setup. This here is dark, so I think this picture is taken out of a cave. Yeah, so here it's rather dark. This region is brighter and the sky is very bright. So if we do a more global tone mapping, yeah, we might end up with something like this. Yeah, so we adapt it to that region, so that's rather well visible. And the more local we do the tone mapping, the better we can see local contrast. But there appear these effects, like, can you here see this dark range here? This is just because if we look at that point, the sky is still included in the sigma computation, but here it's no longer. So here we have a completely different tone mapper, like here, even if the brightness is the same. Yeah. So this is the kind of a try, yeah, to mix different tone mappers varying over the image. And if that happens too fast, then the effect is visible. Yeah. And if we do it too strong, then the effect is not present. So something like this or this here is maybe good. But also here, yeah, you can see these seams at the transition zone between bright and dark ranges. And yeah, it's always a compromise. Okay, good. So in fact, I'm surprised that I was very fast with that chapter. But that's all I wanted to tell you about ray tracing and yeah, this really important tone mapping step afterwards. Yeah, tone mapping is a very important part of ray tracing. Yeah, just writing the values you get to the frame buffer will always result in, yeah, wrongly looking images. And a tone mapper in the end is very important to get something that looks more realistic. And in fact, it's an art to do tone mapping correctly. Okay. So much for this. Are there any questions on tone mapping? Are there any questions on computer graphics in general? None. Okay. Good. Then I have for the evaluation, I know it's very late, but it was the earliest possibility for me to get the chance for the evaluation. So we have two different, yeah, one for the lecture and one for the exercises. And in fact, you know, it's sort of two exercises, the basic exercises and the advanced. But we said it doesn't make sense to separate the two exercises, so we only have tons here for the basic exercises. But yeah, you can also write down comments on the advanced exercises if you think there's a difference or whatever. Yeah. So these tons are for both exercises, and these are for the lecture. And I would ask everybody now after the lecture to come down. I will give two tons. We will have one more lecture in the last week of the semester. That's the first week of February, as far as I remember. And there we will look at exams, and I will show some assignments of the exams, and we can discuss them, and you can ask questions. And if you have later on questions, don't hesitate to send an email to the tutors or to me. And I think the exam will be April 10th or so. So it's still, yeah, quite a long stretch until then. And yeah, use that time. And I wish you a good time. And we will see you again in February. Thank you.